So I am here with Karen Russell, who is the author most recently of Swamplandia. Karen, how are you doing?
I'm doing really well.
Yes. Well, I wanted to, first of all, start with a very basic origin question. This book, initially, was a short story. It was called Ava Wrestles the Alligator. And I'm curious about how Ava Wrestles the Alligator turned into Swamplandia, because the story is quite a bit different than the novel. But on the other hand, there are certain things in the story that do find their way into the book. For example, the story contains a sentence, "My older sister has entire kingdoms inside of her," and in Swamplandia, well, you have a concern for larger territory, worlds, universes, the Birdman saying, "You're on the edge of the universe, kid, and you don't even know it." Kiwi trying to bluff the universe into giving him an answer. And you have the Birdman, more of a vanquished species than a ubiquitous type of guy in the story. And Kiwi isn't nearly as much of a presence in the story as he is in the novel. And I also have to ask what happened to Miss Horta, the science teacher. Lots of questions here, I realize, but hopefully we can kind of get some answers to this about whether you returned to the story to try to gut whatever you could and expand it into the novel. How did this work out?
So it's so funny. It was, you know, that these characters have been around for so long that I almost feel like any origin story I give is just my own myth at this point.
Yeah.
And I can't go back and read the short story. I don't think I've read it in its entirety in years. It's sort of like an old yearbook photo or something,
yeah,
you know, where
sure.
It's just sort of painful to return to. But I do think that the relationship between the sisters, which is sort of the animating force of the novel, was present in that short story.
Yeah.
And Kiwi doesn't exist at all in the story. He was a late-stage addition. When I originally wrote what became the story of Ava Wrestles the Alligator, it was this kudzu mess of like 60 pages and just was really, the sprawl was like itself, you know, this mimetic mangrove sprawl.
Yeah.
Because I really got carried away with that place. I loved that setting and could see it so clearly and wanted to just expand and embroider in a way that's really, you know, my agent and my editor suggested that I do some serious paring down to what ends up being the dramatic action with Ava and Aussie. And then that just did not seem like the plateau to leave those sisters on. I ended feeling very frightened for Aussie and Ava and disturbed about both sisters. And I think at a certain point, I decided it was going to be an underworld story.
Yeah.
So it was going to be the sort of underworld odyssey. You know, there's sort of a nice tradition to work in there.
Well, certainly.
It's not copyrighted by, you know, Persephone.
No lawyers involved.
No, right.
Yeah.
Don't tell the Greeks.
Well, on the other hand, by explicitly referencing the River Styx, as you do about maybe 150, 200 pages into the book, I said to myself when I was reading this, oh, why did she have to go ahead and do that? Because it's kind of nice to have the reader infer that, oh, well, it's a sort of River Styx-like metaphor. I'm wondering if, in relying upon a myth like that, there is a danger in being too explicit. Well, on the other hand, a reader can infer almost a sort of Huck Finn-style situation as well. What of this conundrum?
I really didn't want it to be a one-to-one correspondence with any one of those stories, although I'm sure they're just in our bloodstream, Huck Finn, and as you say, you know, the Odyssey, Dante. I think all of that was definitely percolating. But I think it's dangerous, right, to say this is going to be Hamlet, but in the voice of a parrot, you know, in any sort of way that it reads just as that sort of very direct, correspondence. So,
but at some point, the decision was made to reference the River Styx.
My thinking there was just that Ava, this child, is so glutted on those exact stories, you know, both sort of, you know, the yearling kinds of tales, you know, about heroic kids and their totem animals or whatever, and also the older myths, you know, also these older fairy tales. So that is actually, the River Styx would be something from the Spiritist Telegraph, which is a book that her sister has found on this wrecked library boat. The kids are sort of autodidacts. They are homeschooled on this island, and they go to this wrecked library boat to sort of get this magpie view of the reality outside their island.
Yeah.
So they do have these sort of piecemeal references coming in, and so much of her vision of the world is by analogy, is sort of through the lens of these fairy tales and myths that she's reading. So I didn't want people, you know, but I know I do think it's a danger. I wouldn't want anyone to think that I'm doing, you know, in the octave of the swamp.
Sure. Well, I mean,
Hades.
There is definitely a Stiltsville. There's seven remaining homes of that.
Right.
I'm wondering, if there was actually, there were library boat systems similar to the bookmobiles. So I didn't get a chance to really delve into this. I was trying to look around because that really captured my imagination.
Wouldn't that be great?
It would be fantastic.
What a great idea.
It would make complete sense in an archipelago. You know?
I'm saying, get some government funding. I think it would be so wonderful. And I ended up excising a lot of material about the library boat.
Really?
That didn't really belong.
Yeah.
But I thought, just because I am a nerdy bookworm, my God, that would have been my paradise. If there was a wrecked ship full of books,
yeah,
no librarians to kind of nose around what you were reading, you could just, you know, kind of take and go. And I love the idea that people would come and leave books and take books, you know, which is a system that exists, but that there would just be a book with a sort of constantly evolving library. One of the things
I
like.
Add Borges on top of that, then you've got a really interesting idea.
Get Borges to captain that boat, seriously.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we kind of got in a bit of a flurry here from the original trajectory. Kiwi. I'm curious how Kiwi came to life in this, because he starts off being sort of a side character. Then he becomes, well, this is the other side of the story. And as we pointed out earlier, he's not in the original story.
Right.
Why Kiwi above anybody else, or rather, you know, above, say, Aussie, who just disappears entirely? Because it is interesting that Kiwi is more of an autodidact, where Ava is more of an experiential learner, and I'm curious how this came into being.
Here. Oh, I'm so glad. Yeah, I'm so glad that she reads that way to you. I was thinking, the two sisters. You have Aussie, who is sort of the book's unconscious. I mean, she is totally merged with her idea of herself as this clairvoyant psychic spirit. She goes way off the deep end into the occult. And then Ava, you know, I think that she's sort of on a plateau where she hasn't really committed to any one way of seeing. She's sort of seduced by this world of the ghosts. But she also, I wanted there to be one more voice, one more force. I almost started to think of these three siblings as sort of, you know, the superego, the ego, the unconscious almost, because Kiwi is this hyper-articulate, you know, self-identifies as a genius, you know, knows lots of big words but mispronounces them.
Yeah.
You know,
not schematic,
thinks meningitis
though.
Is a compliment. Right. So he sort of has this idea of himself as a really literate, really astute reader, adult reader of the world. So he, in many cases, is sort of a voice of reason. And I think Ava kind of toggles between these two views. She's got her brother, her older brother, who sort of is a more rooted in reality, you know, informed by, you know, the mainland, albeit, you know, kind of also at the same time stunted and naive because he's grown up on this island 40 miles away from the mainland. And then she has her sister, who's this really sort of frightening, you know, lost character, sort of deranged character. So
yeah.
I don't know if that answers your question, but I want a Kiwi. You know, I was like, the book really needs a character to work in a more comic register, sort of to...
To torture, as you did.
Well, I do, in fact, torture. Yeah. Well, I don't, you know, I don't think that I torture him. I think I just put him in a situation, you know, among mainland teenagers where that is, and then watch what and unfolds.
I interjected, my apologies, that last answer by noting that you were, in fact, seeking a sort of schematic between the id, the ego, and the superego, which is interesting because before you said, oh, I wanted to avoid schematics by referencing the River Styx and all that. This leads me to just kind of, I'm curious to flesh out this issue of where you diverge from the established text and whether there's a certain risk or a danger both ways by adhering too closely or by going completely wild there.
And I think, you know, I think that was just a useful way for me to think about the textures in the book. And I don't think that, at any point I was trying to do a total Freudian.
Sure.
I think it's sort of a very loose, you know, it was what was useful sometimes to think about the book and then you erase your work.
Yeah.
I'm always suspicious of I don't outline it. I don't usually plan that way. It's a lot of it's pretty intuitive, gut level. So
I'm curious. I don't want to ask you the old chestnut of where do you get your ideas, but I do want to ask you how you arrange your ideas. This is a very conceptual book. I mean, there's a lot stacked into this. And the sense I got sometimes was that you would really want to go ahead and hit the gas on one idea, and then there were some ideas where it's like, oh, well, I'm not quite sure I can work them in, but I'm going to try anyway. You mentioned also earlier that, oh, I had to kill the library boat. This must have been a very torturous process. The sense I got from reading this is a very conceptual writer. And so how do you deal with the constant froth of ideas percolating in your brain?
Sure. I think the swamp itself is such a feckin' place, and it's such so overripe in a way with metaphoric possibilities.
Yes.
That is, you know, there is this seduction. I think Swamplini could have spun out infinite stories, infinite side characters. And I was, you know, and it's true. As a writer, you have to be disciplined. You don't want to be too seduced by an interesting storyline that doesn't really contribute to the overall narrative.
Yeah.
So definitely. If you have some specifics, I'm happy to...
Well, actually, I do, as a matter of fact. I actually wanted to talk about your use of time and space to make comparisons often with the head and flesh. This is throughout the book, the house looking like a fat man taking yellow breaths in the dark. I really love that. You have the chief's gray hairs collected in the sink, so you have this aging and the shedding of hairs also reflecting time. And then, of course, the birdman touching the house the way a child might touch the flesh of a strange animal. There's an interesting concern between texture, space, and time that is very often in your description. And I'm curious how this came about. To what degree is this intuitive? To what degree are you aware of your you know, constantly hitting the ride of, oh, hey, it's house and space, or house
how
and man and space and that kind of thing?
Oh, you know, and I could tell you sincerely, that's news to me, you know,
yes.
As a writer. I think that there's certain, you go to the images that have power for you.
Yeah.
Or you return to the places that have power for you, I think, as a writer. So that's just, I love that, the one that you mentioned about the birdman, who is this grifter, this total outsider touching the walls of the house.
Yeah.
As if it was a strange creature. I was just thinking about this total inversion for a person that wild of outside and inside.
Yeah.
But I don't, you know, when I was, it's funny, you know, I think that writers do have certain tics.
Sure.
I have to watch myself about even just vocabulary words, like the word limb. I'm like, oh my God, you get to use that once in a book, once per book, you know.
Michiko ruined it for us here. Yeah. Well, that also leads me to ask you about the origin of Seth. I mean, on one hand, you could say, oh, well, this is a response to the Jacques in The Tale of Two Cities. On another hand, I was thinking, oh, well, maybe she's introducing this to avoid the problem of, like, oh, shit, I'm writing a book about alligators and crocodiles. I can't just use alligators. I can't always consult the thesaurus. Uh-huh. So was Seth the kind of the working prototype of this, similar to the limb
problem?
Well,
Seth came directly from the story.
Yeah.
And I think at that point when I was writing the story, I just thought, I have a bad habit of just cracking my own stuff up. I thought it would be hilarious to have this sign that said Seth the Fanksome Sea Serpent and Lizard of Death.
Yeah.
And then if you've seen Florida alligators on the road, they look a lot like tires. You know, it's sort of the contrast between this sort of biblical charge of a name like Seth and all of these ancient Egyptian implications and stuff. And then you see this thing that really just looks like, a corrugated tire.
Yeah. Do you know any Seths?
No, I don't know any Seth.
Really?
I was also thinking it'd be funny. You know, they name the first Seth. They have this original Seth. And then because all their promotional materials feature Seth, the chief says at one point, tradition is as important as promotional materials are expensive.
Yes.
So
yes.
He's kind of like, but we'll call them all that for tradition's sake. And also because we printed up 1,000 brochures that say Seth on it. So.
While we're on the subject of names, I do have to point out that you do have Louis Thanksgiving Auchinbliss, which is very close to, of course, Louis Auchincloss. Probably conscious, I'm thinking. And of course, you have a character named Emily Barton show up, and I know Emily Barton is a writer, and I read this going, wait a minute, is this the Emily Barton?
Oh, no.
No.
Do you know? You are
really?
Introducing me. I wish, I got to send you my manuscript.
Auchincloss, too?
No. And Emily Barton, maybe her name seeped into my consciousness or whatever, but no, that is no direct diss of Emily Barton.
No, no.
Because I actually dislike that character a good deal. So.
Yeah. Dude, do you know Emily?
I don't know her at all.
Uh-huh.
And,
what about
I'll
the
have to check out her work now. Not conscious. I was thinking, I read the name Auchinbliss somewhere else. I think I was looking through German surnames. There's something about just the contrast between this man who's just hard as a knuckle and this name that opens up into bliss that I liked. That's all that was.
Do you think it's healthy to just essentially move forward? I mean, obviously, this was done 2 years ago, and I suppose I'm presenting a number of things that you weren't aware of that you've long forgotten about. Is it healthier as a writer to just not look back at any of the stories, any of the fiction that you've written, and just move forward, because then you get lost in some retrospective analysis or some sort of second guessing, some concern that you're repeating yourself? Or?
Oh, I think I would love to get to a place where I can reread those stories with a fresh eye.
Yeah.
I mean, at this point with this book too, have worked over the sentences and the chapters so much that I really think it is sort of sunken into like the anonymous molds of thought. I mean, yeah. I really think it's in, you know, in the bloodstream, as I was saying. So it might be a while before I can read it. And I was talking with a friend of mine who said, you know, writers can never experience their own books the way a reader will. That's sure. just not possible.
Yeah.
So, but I do think it's good to be aware of your tics. You don't want to just keep plagiarizing yourself, and yeah. nor do you want to, you know, write the same book 50 times.
But at some point, you sort of have to not be concerned about that and just go ahead and lay it down on the page and just go ahead and riff off of this. I mean, if you were worried about repeating yourself, you wouldn't get any work done.
Yeah, or how depressing to just have your own book on the nightstand. You know, I don't know. I just don't think that that sounds a little incestuous. I don't recommend it. Sounds a little Kentucky. You know? Yeah. I want to get something else in the gene pool.
I wanted to point to a funny punctuational situation. I mean, Swaplandia always has an exclamation mark.
Oh, I fought hard for that.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I did.
Because there's one sentence in this that actually made me kind of say, maybe the exclamation mark may not be necessary. There's a sentence that ends with the exclamation mark. It's, Kiwi worked the 9-hour Friday shift inside Leviathan, and for that period, he forgot all about Swaplandia, exclamation mark. It's like, this is a very, very sad situation. And then Swaplandia, exclamation mark. You mentioned fighting hard for that. Was this a concern, like, if you were to put Swaplandia at the end of a sentence, that it would then cause a sort of besmirching of emotions, or maybe... the besmirching of emotions, the mix of emotions is probably what you were seeking throughout this.
I think that for me personally, sometimes the enthusiasm there speaks to sort of the totally diluted optimism of their dad, Chief Big Tree, and sort of the really, really the painful failure of Swamplandia, you know? So somehow sometimes in the tragic scenes, I don't know if it works this way at all, but for me as a writer, when I went for that sentence, for example, just made the sadness more acute, just made it more poignant, you know, that so much of the stories about this family suiting up in fake Indian costumes and playing these roles for one another and really, you know, trying to power this place just with the engine of their own belief in it. And when it starts to fall apart, you know, then I think you feel how forced that sounds, the exclamation point. You feel the strain of trying to keep this fantasy alive as their world is disintegrating.
Yeah.
So I sort of almost think it sort of underscores just all the effort required to keep this fantasy going, and the pain when it starts to fall away.
I mean, I actually wanted to talk about this pain because child neglect, it is there in the book, but what is fascinating to me is that the world surrounding Ava really doesn't recognize the neglect. They don't even enforce the neglect. I'm thinking at this point throughout the book, oh my God, Child Protective Services is totally going to show up. But it never does. I mean, the kids, they're not able to wash their own clothes. The food supply is dwindling. But you have this character named Whip Jeters, who is a park ranger, who shows up. And the Birdman is there with Ava. And the Birdman says, oh, well, I'm her uncle. And even though Whip can sort of see this and say, you know, there's something fishy going on, there's something possibly neglectful or kidnapping going on, he still believes this in some sense. He even whispers, be safe, Ava, at the end of that chapter. I'm wondering why you didn't have, like, Child Protective Services show up, or why there was this element of, like, you can't enforce clear neglect in this, that you have to leave these children adrift, so to speak. I'm curious why you made that choice.
I think that for this book in particular, they're way off the mainland grid.
Yeah.
I don't think that they are visible to any sort of governmental child protective services. And I don't think it's such a stretch to imagine that even in the world we inhabit, there are pockets of neglect like this where child services can't reach. I mean, I am certain, in fact, that there is a family in the Bronx right now where, you know, something far worse is going on than anything the Big Trees have to endure that's invisible. So for me, you know, it's not... doesn't require such a leap to believe that they might exist in a crack that's not scrutinized by child services. I mean, and also in this book, they're sort of quite a ways. They're 40 miles, and it's only accessible by ferry, and I just think there are still, there, you know, both urban and rural, there are still pockets like this where...
Yeah. Well, that is a good point, because I'm not sure if you've seen some of the intros for, like, the original Sesame Street, 1969. You see kids... literally just running through the streets, completely neglected.
Yeah.
You know, this has changed dramatically in the last 40 years, this idea. But it is interesting that, perhaps in the backland or in the impoverished world, we wouldn't exactly have these sort of parents either overly concerned or very concerned about
right.
their children. Yeah.
Right. And I, you know, I'm so glad you brought up that Whip Jeters moment because I found that so painful, that whole scene.
Yeah.
And probably, you know, just true to experience sometimes where there is an adult who's confronted with, certainly true to my own experience in life, where you're confronted with something that seems to be not right, could require an action, and you're on a ledge and you can decide to either let it go or investigate further.
Or you freeze up or you have a half-hearted reaction to something where you really have to intervene. Yeah.
Right. And it can be a really conscious, it can be a truly willful denial. And in this book, there's so much, you know, both the children characters and the adults in this book, I think, are frequently faced with a choice to sort of easy belief or the consolations of a certain kind of belief or a narrative or really, you know, this cold shock of reality and then the action that would require. So, and their grief, right? Their mom is dead. So I think a lot of it, I was thinking about the way that that can work with grief where, you know, denial is such a common response to something tragic that you don't want to assimilate.
But this is interesting because you also have a situation where this family, the Big Trees, they're plundering from their own history to provide birthday presents for their own. And that was just so sad to me because not even their history is sacrosanct, that they have to also build this museum in order to prove that they existed. And as we learned later in the book, when Ava learns something about her mother, I don't want to give it away, we then discover that, well, maybe history really isn't worth nearly as much as belief. You know, it's the old Liberty Valance situation, you know, print the legend.
Right.
Instead of believing in the truth. And, I'm curious, as a coping mechanism, this kind of cuts both ways.
Yeah.
On one hand, you may be able to get through it, but will you be able to look hard at the reality and avoid these painful moments or confront these painful moments?
Mm-hmm. I think that was the central question for me was, when are the stories we tell, when do they help us? When can they save us, the way that we tell this story? And they are, you know, it's the right kind of consolation. And when is it a delusion with, you know, disastrous consequences? I think that really was for all of the, you know, for Ava and her brother and the chief, you know, that's the big question.
Yeah.
And I love, thank you for not spoiling it.
No.
I get so nervous in interviews that I, you know, I'm going to give away something that'll ruin a reader's enjoyment. So.
I'll tell them about the sled later.
Yeah.
I wanted to actually ask you about the World of Darkness Swamplandia competition.
Mm.
I feel that ball was dropped about like 50 pages into the book. It kind of gets picked up later, almost in a sort of ironic way, by having Kiwi work for the World of Darkness and become this hero. But I am curious why the essential competition was dropped. Was it a matter of just not being able to weave it into the narrative? Was it the fact that this movie Adventureland came out? I mean, you know.
I saw Adventureland, I said,
I can't write this
book. I said, no, a legal battle is coming up. Litigation, forget it.
Yeah.
Detour.
But seriously, I am curious, why did you drop that? Because it sort of gets dropped, and I realize that that's just only one component of the story, but it sort of sets itself up to be that story, and then just kind of drops. So I'm curious why that was.
Sure. Just before I answer that, that's so funny that you mentioned Adventureland because I was describing what I thought was this genius plot for a new story to a friend the other day, and they like let me, you know, say my whole piece, and they were like, "Karen, that's the plot of Ace Ventura: Pet Detective." And it was a humbling moment.
Yeah. Well, there are only so many plots,
right? Know? Well, that's the thing. I think that's when we were talking about the temptation to just invent infinitely. I mean, I think you could. It would have been really fun to write a book where it was Carnival Darwin, you know, this Carnival Darwinism.
Yes.
Swamplandia versus the World of Darkness, and it's like some goofy space race of theme parks, and they keep adding, you know, that seemed, that would have been a total joy to write, I think, but I think that would have been a different book, and I think that, although that competition kind of puts the pressure on the, you know, I wanted to sort of turn the heat up for this Big Tree family, they're really facing fiscal insolvency, in addition to, you know, dealing with the grief of their mom, I mean, their financial survival and their ownership of the island is threatened too. But I think some of the tragedy of the book is that Chief Big Tree, the proprietor of this mom and pop park, ever believed that he was an equal rival to this massive corporation. I think that just speaks to sort of his, you know, unchecked that his optimistic delusion in a way. I don't think that it was ever a true fight. You know, I sort of think his marshaling, you know, his sort of the way that he infects Ava, his youngest child, with his desire to save the park, is sort of part of this really uncritical faith that is the danger, you know, that the danger that fuels a lot of the plot of the book is just uncritical faith in, you know, in the in their own, the, this idea that the Swamp Lady would ever be a rival for this massive corporation like that. That's one of the facts that they have to, you know, have to deal with over the course of the book.
Certainly, but on the other hand, uncritical faith is also what leads Kiwi to being a hero later in the book. So it kind of cuts both ways here.
Well, how so?
Because there is, you used the words optimistic delusion to describe, and I didn't see it so much as delusional as just trying to, trying to put a rosy spin with the asterisk.
And
clearly.
Brave, too, and courageous, too. You know, I think also very courageous.
But the faith in Kiwi later, after he saves, you know, someone, that to me is just as much of an optimistic delusion as what the big trees themselves are believing in. So it almost cuts both ways. You're going to run up against it no matter how evil and pernicious the capitalistic forces are. And in this case, the World of Darkness forces are really terrible.
They truly are, right? Well, I would say that the World of Darkness is enmeshed in a much larger system, you know, in a capitalist system, and the chief's refusing to look at the bank ledgers and really hard, cold facts. And Kiwi and Ava, I think, I wouldn't say it's uncritical faith, but I think they do sort of come to have a faith in their own capacities, you know, and a belief in themselves, and you know, and that is, as cheesy as that sounds, I mean, I think a really beautiful progress for both of those guys.
But it is interesting that the corresponding virtue, so to speak, of World of Fantasy are these dark fantasies, this belief in the dead, in ghosts. To marry a ghost is your fantasy, which is, and to really excavate history to find some kind of fantasy that you can cling to in the present is an extremely sad, but for me, very moving predicament. And I'm curious, how some of these things juxtapose. Because when you swap between the two sections, you see a lot of parallels in terms of, you know, where something leads off like this. Like, one character is in this spot in their quest, and we see the other character is in this spot in their quest.
Thank you.
Yeah. So,
I'm glad. Thank God. I'm glad you saw that. Thank you.
So, lots of observations. Let me try to cram that into a simple inquiry if I can. Lining up these very spots while also paying attention to opposing virtues, opposing fantastical virtues. How did this kind of mesh into the great big structure?
trying to find parallels for Ava and Kiwi's journeys, so they both go kind of on their own hell trips. They both go into their own underworlds.
While simultaneously subverting the notion of fantasy.
Right. So, I think that's sort of what are the stories that are helpful versus what are the stories that can kill you, can hurt you. And I think for both of them, they wake up. They become more conscious of, in Kiwi's case, of the limits of this larger world. He's working for the World of Darkness.
Yeah.
He's sort of a Trojan horse inside the World of Darkness, trying to make money to help his family's park. And it's a hell insofar as it's just this completely dehumanizing, exploitative, minimum wage, slave labor system that runs the dream, you know, that runs this dark Disney. So I think he sort of sees the backstage costs and sort of comes to understand his own limitations. He's not a genius by any stretch. He's going to night school and getting, C++. But he also gets to test in the real world his own abilities. And Ava, I think that's sort of her journey too, even though she's in a darker, nightmarish, maybe mythic register. She also starts out with these really, with the tales that we all cut our teeth on when we're kids. So, with a child's, you know, egotism a little bit, I can save the world, I can save my family, I can save this park.
Yeah.
I, with a child's wish to find her dead mother and communicate directly to wrest her mom and her sister back from the underworld. So she starts her quest there.
But it's almost implied that Kiwi's quest to save the park almost comes from his book learning. Like, he's managed to excavate some old rule value of, like, okay, Max Weber here.
Right.
I'm going to go ahead.
Oh, absolutely, which seems equally naive, right? Which is sort of just as naive in the sense as Ava's fairy tales that she begins the journey with, I would say. It's Kiwi's, like, Right. I've got the facts, and I mean, there's an egotism there too.
Yeah.
And he thinks, he really does think that he's this.
Is it really so egotistical, do you think?
I think it's a farce. That he believes that he is a genius with all the facts, and that he understands the mainland, a place that he's never been except for in books.
Yeah. Yeah.
So egotism might not be, you know, naivete, I guess, is another way of, you know.
I would say that. I mean, I don't think he doesn't have a curiosity in the mainland, or for that matter, these planes that are flying over and the like that we see later in the book. It's clear that's why I'm thinking to myself, well, his intentions are for the family, so therefore, is that really an egotistical virtue?
Well, I realize now I sound so judgmental. I love both these characters, and I think that they're very courageous.
Sure.
I guess I just, they're not conscious yet of their limits, and they're not conscious of, you know, the blinders they have on, I suppose, from their upbringing.
I wanted to shift tacks really quickly. I wanted to remark upon the many sentence blanks with this book. You have the musical qualities of a telephone number where we see seven blanks. You have a moment later in the book where Kiwi recognizes that anger requires a direct object. I am angry at blank. I hate blank. I'm curious if this also kind of came about in the writing process where you actually had blanks that you were trying to fill a word there. I mean, curious concern for blanks. Hey, where does this come from?
I draft all my projects like a crossword puzzle. Yes. That's your...
Well, across, down in this original story, too.
Across. I think I didn't necessarily connect those two instances of blanks. There's one where it's just the phone number, and I thought, I'm not going to put the phone number in there. You know, it's just sort of, this is the do-do-do-do-do. You know, we old school, and we all called each other on landlines. You know the music of your own home number.
Yeah.
And with Kiwi, I think those blanks just reference a sort of like a deep grammar. He's saying anger requires a direct object. He has all of this sort of, he has this rage, and he doesn't know who to direct it at. So he's sort of coming up against, you know, the frustration of having an outrage and not knowing its target.
Yeah.
So that's what that blank, I think that's what I was thinking.
How do you face the blank page? Well, there's an awful little tie-in here.
That was like a Tarzan segue. That was amazing. Yeah. we swung into the blankness. I had with a lot of coffee. I don't have a hard time generating material usually. It's sort of focusing it and refining it that is more difficult. I have a really good time drafting, and then I need to do many revisions.
Yeah, got it. One last question, because we do have to wrap this up. I was curious how your relationship was with Jordan Pavlin. I was always curious because there seemed to be in Jordan's work a lot of like cultural references, and I'm wondering if she had, you know, encouraged you, hey, gotta have more of that pop culture in this book or anything like that.
Oh, you mean in her author's
book? Yes, exactly, in her author's book. And there's some moments in this where like, I wonder if Jordan Pavlin said, okay, Karen, you gotta get some pop culture in here or something like that. What did she encourage? What aspects of the book did she want to see more of, or did she try to
push it? God above for Jordan. I could not have. She is the lottery win, ultimate lottery win for an editor. I don't know that we talked about pop culture at all, except that I fought to keep in, you know, expletives in my invented hip-hop songs.
Yeah. Exclamation marks and expletives were a concern? Well, I mean, I can't believe there would be a fight for this. People say these things all the time. The high schoolers pass notes.
I drew my line in the sand.
Text messages.
I'm a woman of principles. I want exclamation points. I want FUs. It's sort of sad
meetings.
What I had the battles about. I know. It's a little depressing, huh?
Why was there a concern? I mean, that blows me away.
No. I was just, I really wanted to keep a sense of what it's like to be a teenager in South Florida. And a lot of it is, you know, drawn directly from my own experience making requests on Power 96. So we kept some of that in there. I don't think that Jordan had much to say about any of that. But didn't discourage me from having like Haters Will Hemorrhage Blood and other hip hop songs in there. Pop culture. She was a great help to me. So much of the book really turns on this metaphysical pivot that happens relatively late in the book.
Yeah.
And in a way that was not true of the short stories, I really had a conscious aim for this effect that I wanted to achieve that seemed very delicate. And it was tough to gauge how it was reading to another person. And I thought that Jordan was really just very savvy and exquisitely sensitive to these really sort of careful calibrations that would allow you to live in an uncanny, you know, that would prolong this hesitancy between reality and fantasy.
Yeah.
That seemed really essential to for the book to work.
Such as what? Was there a particular section that really...
I think the Birdman's character. Yeah. When the characterization of the Birdman and when to tip my hat in which direction, how he was reading, you know, how sinister he was reading, how if he was charming. You know, I had a very definite idea of how I wanted him to read, but it's you need a great editor to help you echolocate, or you don't know how he's showing up in, you know... That's an occult game that you have to play as a writer to kind of guess what a reader might be thinking.
So. Yeah. Well, on that fluttery note, Karen, thanks so much. It was a pleasure chatting with you.
It was great. Yeah. Thanks so much for having me.
Absolutely.